welcome to the podcast for TheForce.net. My name's Eric, and I'm your host, bringing you the latest news, commentary, and events from the Star Wars community. The clock has just moved from Monday night into Tuesday morning. In just under 48 hours, those of you not already doing so will be in line for the last Star Wars film ever. Star Wars fans everywhere are going through a very broad spectrum of emotions right now. Most are starting with excitement, then anticipation, then caution given the disappointment of Episode 1, then excitement again, realizing that this is the Star Wars prequel we've all been waiting for, then disappointment that there won't be any others, then dread because they can't seem to visualize Star Wars beyond this point, then despair that the era of new Star Wars content seems to be drawing to a close. I'm going to address this topic a little bit later in the podcast, but for right now I'm going to forego news coverage again, like in recent podcasts, and continue discussing Episode 3. After all, the rest of the news pales in comparison to the mere existence of this film and the fact that it's only 2 days away. I'd like to take a few minutes and look back at the saga so far and take a look at what needs to be wrapped up, what loose plot threads exist, what questions need to be answered, what George is holding back from us. Of course, not all questions need to be answered. There's still the expanded universe, and when you really think about it, the vast majority of questions that we've actually gotten answers to over the last 30 years have been answered in the expanded universe. So we just need to be patient. Episode 3 is not going to answer all of our questions. It wraps up several plot threads, but some aren't covered at all, and new plot threads are introduced in the movie too. So just keep in mind that it took ages for us to get many questions answered about the original trilogy. We just need to be patient. Of course, patience isn't exactly high on our list right now, is it? We've got 48 hours left until Revenge of the Sith. We're exercising about all the patience we can handle at the moment. So at the risk of sounding like a hypocrite, here's my list of things that we Star Wars fans are still wondering about. Let's start with Anakin's conception. Now, actually, let's take a step even further back. Several steps, actually. Let's look at the nature of the Force itself. Many Star Wars fans groaned when midichlorians were first brought up in Episode 1, and most breathed a sigh of relief when it wasn't mentioned again in Episode 2. In the original trilogy, the Force was always regarded as either a religion or a philosophy. It was never clearly explained whether anybody could become a Jedi with sufficient training, or whether it was restricted to just a select few. And now we find out there's actually a blood test. There are some people who have no problem with the symbiosis of science and religion, but traditionally most people have had a problem resolving one with the other. And if Lucas is going to step into this arena, he really needs to explain what's going on. Another ancient issue, if you will, is that of the Jedi Order itself. Someone had to have established it initially, right? Who was it? Why did they do it? Which came first, the Jedi or the Sith? Speaking of the Sith, I know a lot of you still don't understand the whole Sith thing. Some people think it's a race, some people think it's a philosophy. It's kind of both. The Sith actually were a race a long time ago. They died out, and they haven't been around in ages. Now, it's been a while since I've read up on them, but for more information, check out The Tales from the Jedi, The Golden Age of the Sith, and the Jedi vs. Sith comic books. And thanks to Jay for the references. Jumping back to the prequel era, we know that Palpatine's a pretty manipulative guy. He starts out as merely one of a billion senators, and he ends up emperor of the entire galaxy. In Episode 1, we see him manipulate events in such a way as to get himself elected Supreme Chancellor, and likely even help start the Separatist movement on their way. In Episode 2, he continues playing both sides of the fence, creating a situation where it was necessary he be voted emergency powers, giving him the ability to create a grand army of the Republic. Yet we all know there was even more going on here. Most of the people I know can hardly plan their schedules out for 2 weeks in advance. Yet Palpatine was obviously pulling the strings from before the opening of Phantom Menace. But how far did his influence go? What was he actively manipulating, and what was just a matter of him taking advantage of coincidences? There are lots of things left unexplained. Was he involved in Anakin's conception? I remember rumors that Ara Singh, only seen briefly in Episode 1, was originally going to be involved somehow with the death of Anakin's mom. Obviously, that's changed quite a bit, but did Palpatine have anything to do with the death of Shmi Skywalker? Obviously, he couldn't have done a whole lot to get Anakin and Padme together, but knowing Anakin's attachment to his mother, it seems plausible that Palpatine was at work there somehow. The Jedi also affected events through their involvement, obviously, so how much of that was Palpatine able to plan for ahead of time? And what were Count Dooku's motivations behind all this? I'm guessing he really was a political idealist, and he really was trying to bring about a change of government, and just got in a little over his head. And I think Anakin falls into the same trap. Looking back on all the villains in the series, Palpatine is the only one that really strikes me as pure evil. Even Maul was barely touched on in the first film, and what little we do know about him is that he sought revenge. We don't exactly know for what, which I guess is another thing that could be explained, but I see the desire for revenge as severely misguided. Palpatine, on the other hand, is just plain evil. And I know many people are asking about Jedi Master Sifo Dyas. Master Sifo Dyas did, in fact, order the clone army. This whole situation is explained in the novel Labyrinth of Evil. As for the good guys, what's up with the Jedi? I mean, they've got a boy with a midichlorian count higher than Yoda, whom is believed to possibly be the Chosen One, yet they don't want to bother with him because he's a little bit too old. Then after they find out there's a pair of Sith running around all these years, they're keeping an eye open, right? Sure, unless it's about Count Dooku. You've got a Jedi who leaves the Order, becomes a political activist working to bring about the downfall of the Republic. Then you've got a prominent senator who believes that he may be behind the assassination attempts on her. You're going to brush him off as a political idealist? What? This guy should be your primary suspect. I mean, talk about dropping the ball. Oh, and a clone army ordered by a Jedi Master goes totally undetected. Their ability to use the Force is diminished so much that Mace Windu himself suggests informing the Senate. I mean, we're not talking about some Jedi with migraines here. He's actually going to humble the entire Jedi Order before the Senate and explain that they're unable to use the Force like they once were. I mean, that's a pretty major thing there. And then, well, I don't want to get too much into the details of Episode 3, but let's just say that they continue to make mistakes. Dumb mistakes. I mean, what's up with these guys? What I want to know is this. Are the failings of the Jedi philosophical failures, or are they directly results of Palpatine's involvement? That excuse about the dark side clouding everything seems just a little bit too convenient for me. But even if it is the dark side clouding things, there are definitely some serious philosophical points too. Would it not be better to learn to control one's emotions rather than suppress them entirely? Is passion really that bad a thing? It too can be a source of focus. And it leads to some pretty cool things, such as creativity, devotion, sacrifice, perseverance. Are these automatically bad things? I mean, the Jedi preach against attachment, yet what about the attachment a Jedi has to such a rigid rule structure? Some people have asked about the drastic change in the way Obi-Wan and Yoda teach Luke in the original trilogy. I'd like to think that the differences are because Obi-Wan and Yoda see that the old ways didn't work out too well, and so they've wisened up a little bit. Speaking of those two, I'd like to know if there are any other Jedi that survive. If Obi-Wan and Yoda can remain hidden all this time, isn't it possible that other Jedi can too? Especially out in the outer rim of the galaxy? And how did Obi-Wan and Yoda stay hidden so well? Personally, I think Obi-Wan just made a very wise choice in his location. When it comes to emotional baggage, it doesn't get much worse for Vader than Tatooine, and especially his so-called family there. Between Obi-Wan becoming a hermit and Luke staying with relatives whose memory Vader's actively trying to repress, I think it was the perfect spot. As for Yoda and Dagobah, I'd like to know a little bit more about what's going on there. Is it true that he's there because the cave is so strong in the dark side of the Force that it masks him? In the Thrawn trilogy, we see how the Force is used elsewhere in nature. Some animals hunt with it, and some animals can even negate its effect as a defense mechanism. So, what's up with this cave? And is it why Yoda chose Dagobah? But don't I remember seeing in a comic somewhere that Qui-Gon takes a young Anakin to the cave too? So it's not exactly well hidden, is it? And who is this Yoda guy anyway? I mean, he's been training Jedi for 800 years, and yet we know almost nothing about him. Where's he from? What's his race called? What's his middle name? How tall was he before he started slouching all the time? Of course, maybe it's best not to know too much about him. Boba Fett used to be really cool because he was so mysterious, but as more and more was revealed about him, he kind of lost his coolness. Sometimes we're better off not knowing too much about a character's backstory. Wolverine from Marvel Comics is another good example of this. When he was enigmatic and shrouded in mystery, he was much cooler. And the same went for Boba Fett, and I think the same goes for Yoda, too. Let's not find out anything more about him. Let's leave well enough alone. So that brings us up to Luke and Leia. Why does Luke turn into this Jedi Master, and Leia gets the short end of the stick? After all, now that this whole midichlorian thing has been explained, they should both be equal, right? After all, they're twins. I'm surprised at how often this question's come up. I think this actually can be explained pretty easily. Obi-Wan found Luke and trained him. Vader found Leia and threw her in a cell. Pretty easy to see how one of them became a Jedi, huh? What about Leia's comments in Return of the Jedi when Luke asks her about her mother? First, Padme's fate needs to be addressed, and it's pretty obvious that Episode 3 will somehow address the fate of Padme. Either she lives through the events of the movie or she doesn't. It's pretty simple. Leia's exact words when Luke asked her what she remembers are just images, really. Feelings. She was very beautiful, kind, but sad. If Padme lives through the events of Episode 3, it's possible that Leia stays with Padme for a while before going to Bail Organa of Alderaan. But what if Padme dies? Well, let's think about it. The only way Leia ever does exhibit any Force ability is in regards to sensing other people. Is it not possible that she was able to feel her mother through the Force even in the womb? After all, she was the daughter of the most powerful Jedi in history. And if she were present when Padme dies, wouldn't she sense the feelings of others around her? People who were looking at Padme's beauty reflecting back on her kindness, but feeling sad? As Leia said, she remembers images, feelings. Perhaps those feelings aren't her own. Given the bloodline we're talking about, I don't see this as being too far-fetched. Oh, and speaking of which, in what way does proximity affect the ability to sense someone in the Force? Vader didn't detect Obi-Wan until Obi-Wan was already on the Death Star, and when he came up behind Luke's fighter, he sensed Luke. In Return of the Jedi, he senses Luke when Luke approaches the moon of Endor, and Luke senses Vader. And Palpatine claims he sensed no one, but come on, who's going to believe him? A lot of people want to know why Vader doesn't recognize either C-3PO or R2-D2. Well, first you need to remember that R2-D2 and Darth Vader never meet. As for C-3PO, there are so many protocol droids in the galaxy, what makes you think Vader would recognize him? I don't think 3PO was ever mentioned by name in front of Vader, and I think the only time in the original trilogy that they were ever near each other was on Cloud City. And even if Vader did recognize him, that's a part of his life he's repressed. Remember, Anakin Skywalker has ceased to exist. What about the other way around? Why doesn't C-3PO recognize Vader? There's some speculation as to whether the droid's memories will get wiped in Episode 3. If it does, there's your answer. If not, again, the only time C-3PO ever meets Vader is on Cloud City, and he's not exactly his normal self, if you know what I mean. And what about the Jedi ghosts? We hear Qui-Gon yelling Anakin's name in Episode 2, and apparently so does Yoda. Does this get explained at all in Episode 3? And finally, what exactly is meant by the prophecy that someone will bring balance to the Force? What exactly is balance? Is it an equal amount of good and evil? Is it the absence of both good and evil? I know that this topic has been discussed quite a bit over the years, especially in the TFN forums, but if you've got an opinion on this, drop me an email at podcast@theforce.net and let me know what you think. The theme of this podcast episode is questions, and above all else, there is one question going through the mind of almost every Star Wars fan. What now? Looking back to 1977, we spent 6 years during which there were more Star Wars movies in the works. Then we had nothing from 1983 to... when were the special editions and prequels announced? Let's say maybe 10 years later for the special editions, and probably a couple more years for the prequels. So, from sometime around 1993 to 2005, there have been more Star Wars movies in the works. For almost 20 of the last 30 years, we've been able to count on new content in theatrical releases. We've had news to keep up with, spoilers to either hunt down or avoid at all costs. We've always had something on the horizon. Now, when you're a kid, you've got the first day of school coming up, and then after that, there's Christmas a few months away, and then you've got spring break, and then summer vacation. There are always milestones to look forward to. Lather, rinse, and repeat. But then one day you get out into the real world and you get hit with this shock. There's nothing to look forward to anymore. But you eventually learn that that's not entirely true. You just have to see things from, as Obi-Wan said, a different point of view. And it's not just the film situation we need to look at differently either. The other sources of new content in the Star Wars universe, traditionally, have been the comics and the novels. One comic book title is getting dropped, and the other two are getting a makeover. And as for the novels, we've no longer had a steady, consistent path. The New Republic era has come and gone, as has the New Jedi Order, and as have the Clone Wars. And while there are all kinds of stories you can scatter throughout the various eras, it's difficult to see any particular ongoing story arc anymore. For anything that takes place during an era that's already been bookended, one feels like they already know how things are going to turn out. The only light at the end of the tunnel seems to be the legacy storyline, set after the New Jedi Order, and there are many fans who feel somewhat skeptical of the new generation of characters. So, as I said, what now? Remember this. We had practically nothing from 1983 until 1991 when Timothy Zahn released Heir to the Empire. And even then, it was a few years before we heard anything about the new Star Wars movies, and even later before we heard about the prequels. And back then, we didn't even have any consistent comic book series. We've been through worse. The comics have been good so far, and the Republic storylines have proven once again that there's a lot you can do with secondary and tertiary characters. Likewise, there really are many things to cover in the existing novel eras, and there's no reason secondary characters can't succeed there too. Keep in mind, it's a huge galaxy out there, as the prequels have shown us. The original trilogy gave us very little exposure to it. There's all kinds of untapped material across all eras of the chronology. Not buying it, huh? Still not good enough for you? Well, that's okay, because there's one more thing that we've got this time around that we didn't have back in 1983. We've got the television series. And I know there are a lot of mixed opinions about this, but all you naysayers should keep a couple of things in mind. First, most of the complaints about the prequels have had to do with three things: bad dialogue, bad directing, and too much of the story being cut for the sake of pacing. And yeah, we might run into this a little bit with the television show, too. But so what? Most of you can't envision anything being worse than Phantom Menace anyway, so what's the big deal? In addition, Lucas is only going to be starting the series. He said he's going to get things up and running, and then he's going to step back and let other people do it. So there goes your bad dialogue and bad directing, right? Oh, and if you believe the rumors, Kevin Smith is going to be one of the people involved. And while he might not be the best filmmaker in the world, he's not too bad, and dialogue and directing are two things he's pretty talented with. And as for the pacing, things work very differently in television than they do in a film. Very differently. I won't go on too much about that right now, but I don't think the story will end up on the cutting room floor this time around. So, if you can concede that the television show will be at least as good as Episode 2, perhaps with a more cohesive story, that's not too shabby, right? And we've got 100 hours coming up over 4 or 5 years. Right now, only about 12 hours of video content exists in the Star Wars universe. And no, I'm not counting those Ewok movies. So, 12 hours compared to 100 hours? Trust me, you'll survive. Spoiler hounds will be on the hunt once again. News junkies will have their fix. The Star Wars fan community is not in danger of dying out after May 19th. So please, go enjoy standing in line. With the advent of internet ticket sales and the fact that the Star Wars franchise is migrating from the box office to the home theater, this very well may be the last line in which you'll spend more than an hour or two for a movie. This is it, the last one. This is the extinction you should be both mourning and celebrating, the last extended line to get into a movie. But do not mourn the Star Wars saga. There's a lot more to come. Trust me, you'll see. While I always feel cheesy quoting Star Wars lines, even in the podcast, the Force really will be with you always. I'll leave you with that. As always, remember that the opinions expressed here are my own and do not reflect those of other TFN staff members nor of Lucasfilm. TheForce.net is not affiliated with Lucasfilm in any way. Now, get out there and share the experience with your friends. Enjoy the time you spend in line, celebrate this last final film, and tell us what you think about it. Until next time, take care, enjoy the film, and may the Force be with you.